listening to a podcast from The National.
Hi, welcome to Extra Time, The National's football podcast. I'm your host, John Turner. Joining me on the show this week is sports reporter John McCauley. John, how you doing, mate?
I'm very well, thanks.
And deputy sports editor Steve Luckings. Steve, how you doing?
Hello, mate. I'm well. How are you?
Not too bad at all. We'll also be joined on the phone a little bit later by European football correspondent Andy Mitten. So, the transfer window may be closed until the new year, and the international break may have deprived us of Premier League football, but there is still plenty to discuss this week. On this week's show, we'll be covering the whole sorry saga on deadline day involving Alexis Sanchez, Chelsea's late flurry of business, and give our verdicts on the best and worst deals of the summer. We'll also look ahead to this weekend as the Premier League restarts after the break and fans get to see their new signings in action. So, gents, without any further ado, Sanchez. He was supposed to go to City, but wasn't. Arsenal tried to get in Thomas Lamar for 90-odd million, but couldn't. He now stays at Arsenal. He's unhappy. The fans are unhappy. Pep Guardiola's unhappy. Everyone's unhappy. It's a bit of a mess, really, wasn't it?
It really is. And the reports I'm hearing out of the Arsenal camp suggest that there was a general consensus among the rest of the Arsenal players that they were desperate to kick him out. They were desperate for Alexis Sanchez to leave. And again, it's something we've touched on last week after the 4-0 humiliation to Liverpool. The look of frustration on his face at his teammates. But you can very well envisage the rest of the Arsenal players' frustration with Sanchez. You know, the fact that he was never shy about hiding. He's almost utter contempt for them and their abilities on the pitch. And now, like you say, it's a whole sorry mess. No one got what they wanted out of that deal. And it's going to be very hard, you would imagine, for Sanchez to be integrated back into that team. Now, obviously, nothing says I'm sorry like a couple of match-winning performances. And that really is Sanchez's only way back in with his teammates, you would think, at this point.
John, the whole... Wenger's stance the entire time was basically... at least what everyone thought from a financial point of view was keep Sanchez, get back into the top four in Champions League, risk losing him for free is probably more financially beneficial than selling him this year and then hampering your chances of getting back into the Champions League. But it now looks like it might actually be like a double defeat. Their chances of getting back in the top four at the moment, at least, don't look great. And you're still going to lose Sanchez for free at the end of the season.
Yeah, I don't think there was a lot of joined up thinking with Arsenal this summer, because if you remember, I'm nearly sure whenever he agreed to the 2-year contract, or it got announced anyway, that Ivan Gazidis had said that this was the real catalyst for change, and it seemed that everything was there for spending more money. Because remember, Arsenal are still the top five or six richest clubs in the world, I think, at the moment. So they needed to get back into the Champions League. That should have been the priority this season. So it seemed as if everything was there to maybe go forward in the transfer market and add to Sanchez, and obviously they did that with Lacazette, but if you just look, it doesn't, the whole Thomas Lamar thing was,
it just happened so late in the day, didn't it? Like, how did they propose, you know, you would think they weren't going to sanction a deal for Sanchez unless they had Lamar lined up, but it never seemed at any point like they had that one in to let one go. It just seemed like an absolute shambles from the outside.
Yeah, and you think he was playing an international fixture deadline day, so you wonder, how do you let it go down to that close to the wire? Plus, you've got to remember as well, at the start of the summer, did Wenger not say that 50 million was too much for Lamar? And then it transpires that towards the end of the window that they're bidding almost double that. So yeah, it just shows you it's very, very puzzling there. And I've mentioned it before, but I think it's all to do with the structure at the club. You've got the structures around one man, basically, and it's Wenger, and he just doesn't really seem to know what he's doing. There's too much blind faith, I would say, in a lot of the team that he's got there.
That's the thing. You think about how many managers and people within English football would criticise the role of the director of football, but now you look at one not being at Arsenal and the absolute chaos that's kind of unfolded there, that they need someone like that to kind of take care of contract renewals, to make sure these things don't happen, to handle these types of things that Wenger clearly hasn't got as big a grip on as perhaps he used to.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, they're going into their final year, three players are going into the final year of their contract, Alexis Sanchez, Mesut Ozil and Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, who departed for Chelsea. Now, if you're going to class three of those as your best performers, it's criminal that you've got to that situation. And I think it was always likely they were going to lose at least one of them three players. And from a personal point of view, I think I'd have been more inclined to have seen Mesut Ozil go out the door. But, you know, it was Oxlade-Chamberlain they lost. Not for fantastic money if we're looking at the current wave of the transfer market, when you're thinking, you know, 40, 50 million will get you a very good player. And they've sold him for, you know, between 35, 40 million. It's very hard to get an exact number out of clubs these days. But, you know, it's going to be very hard to think that a deal for Sanchez won't be revived in January, you would think, from City.
Steve, can I just say, I think that, is it not Arsenal have something like 10 first-team players or considered first-team players that have got 2 years left or less on their contracts, which, how do you let it get to that situation? And again, this comes from a manager who seems to control everything there, and as we touched upon before, he's let his own contract situation run down at the end of the season where no one actually knew what was going on, and he's admitted since that it was disruptive for the tail end of last season. So they've just got themselves in a right mess, and it's difficult to see anyone else to blame other than the manager.
And yet, did you see that he did an interview on French television saying that the question was asked, are you unhappy with Arsenal's transfer business? And he said, no. How could he be happy with losing Oxlade-Chamberlain, not getting in someone like Thomas Lamar, and keeping someone clearly as someone who's become a very divisive figure in that squad in Sanchez?
It's almost like everything's going against Arsenal because, like, the next day Thomas Lamar slapped in a worldie for France, didn't he? Just like every little thing. You know, thanks very much. One of the other top clubs where they were kind of considered having poor transfer business managed to push a few late deals through. The reigning champions, Chelsea. Of course, there was a lot of frustration direct from their manager's mouth, Antonio Conte, about the business that he wanted to get done that wasn't being done in the transfer market. They pushed through a couple of deals on deadline day. What are your thoughts on those? Danny Drinkwater, the former Leicester midfielder, and a bit of an unknown quantity to most football fans, the Torino fullback Zappa Costa, if I've said that right. He's got a little bit of extra squad depth that he really needed.
Well, you know, and I don't wish to be unkind, John, but you say them two names, and my first thought is underwhelming. You know, I don't think Danny Drinkwater is a bad player. I think he's a good player. I don't think he's necessarily the kind of player that comes in and improves Chelsea. Zappa Costa, again, I know very little about. I know Conte gave him his first cap for Italy, so he's obviously someone that he rates highly. But those are the players they got in. You look at the players they missed out. Now, Oxlade-Chamberlain, a fee was agreed between Arsenal and Chelsea, and Oxlade-Chamberlain chose to go to Liverpool. And you have to ask your question. And, of course, earlier in the summer, Romelu Lukaku chose to go to Manchester United over Chelsea. And so my thinking is, what do these players see in this current Chelsea team? Yeah, they're the Premier League champions. They were the best team in the country last season. What have they seen in the very early makings of this 2017 edition of Chelsea that they think, no, you know what, my future is better served somewhere else? Yeah, I don't think they've done terrible business. I think Morata, Bakayoko and Rudiger are very good players. Again, Drinkwater, I think is an okay player, not someone who necessarily Chelsea fans will be falling over at the sound of, but it does seem such a marked contrast for so many players not to want to join the champions of England.
And you've got to remember as well, they missed out on Barkley, is what we think anyway. We don't know if he's decided maybe that he would be better served going to Tottenham in January or whenever, but they missed out Llorente, who
hijacked by Spurs.
Yeah, exactly, makes a change. But Llorente has a lot of friends in the Chelsea camp, apparently, obviously national teammates. He's worked with Conte before, so you thought that would just be a given. You thought everyone talks about how good it is to work for Conte and how he actually coaches players and improves them, even though Llorente's 32. So it just smacks of there's something wrong there. And I don't know whether or not Llorente got wind of that or don't know, he's heard kind of murmurings from inside the Chelsea camp that all's not quite right. But I still, at the end of the day, as Steve said, I still think that Chelsea are stronger than they went into the summer. They've got a stronger squad, but I don't think they're anywhere near as strong as what Conte wanted them to be.
Do you think some of these players might be a little bit wary of the short-termism at Chelsea in terms of you don't know who your manager might be next year, whereas you could be an Oxlade-Chamberlain and feel relatively confident that Klopp will be in charge for the next few years, that you can be part of a stable and consistent project, whereas at Chelsea you just don't know what's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter what you do at Chelsea, really, does it? You can deliver the double one season, be out on your ear the next. And I think Conte is very much... has played a very big part in that. You know, I think over the summer, again, with these constant gripes and these constant grumblings about the transfer activity at Chelsea, have not reinforced his position. You know, there's been lots of murmurings and rumblings of disquiet about his own future. And we all know from his past, he walked out on Juventus after what leading them to three consecutive Serie A titles. He's not a man who's afraid to drop the shoulder and walk out on a job that he doesn't feel he's getting the support and backing he needs. So, yeah, maybe that played a role in it. I guess one glaring fact that we may have overlooked is that these other players may have been offered much more money to go somewhere else, which, again, you would find hard to conceive given how well Chelsea do pay. And like I said, they are the champions of England, offer Champions League football. But there is obviously something that the players got wind of or something that did not sit right about a move to Stamford Bridge with them.
And you've got to remember, still unresolved, Diego Costa. That's rumbled on all summer. So what's going on there? So there are a lot of unanswered questions, I would say, at Chelsea.
What about the rest of the business on deadline day, chaps? There was plenty of other moves, some really surprising ones, some really quite impressive moves, really, and ones that were to clubs that were perhaps you'd consider less fashionable clubs. There's a deal that really stuck out for you, like, so we'll kind of go over the deals that kind of stuck out each for us. You can go first because I know that you've
best of luck.
I've been dying to talk about this. Now, for me, West Brom pulling off a move for, and I apologise to any of our Polish listeners if I'm saying this name wrong, but Grzegorz Krychowiak from PSG on a season-long loan, for me, is a real statement of intent. Now, I was lucky enough to watch Krychowiak at the Euro 2016 quarterfinal, Poland versus Portugal, a game that Renato Sanchez also played in. And again, he was superb. But Krychowiak was the best player on the pitch by an absolute mile. He had every other player in his pocket. His passing range was superb. And again, I couldn't pronounce his name then. I'm probably not doing it right now. But speaking to a load of the Polish fans afterwards, and they all said, like, he's the real deal. He had just finalised his deal from Sevilla to PSG, and they said, watch out for him. Now, obviously, it didn't work out that great for him at PSG, but, you know, given that players like Angel Di Maria may not even get a game there this season, I don't think you can necessarily qualify that as a smudge against his name as such. And given the kind of players that West Brom tend to bring in, you know, like a Gareth Barry is the most West Brom signing, the most Tony Pulis signing ever, isn't he? But Krychowiak is in a completely different league, and all of a sudden they look like a very, very good and have a very good, strong Premier League squad.
And he can play a number of positions. He doesn't just have to be a defensive midfielder or the kind of person that kind of orchestrates everything for them. If he recaptures the form he had at Sevilla a couple of years ago, they've got an absolute steal there.
At the very least, he can even put himself in a shot window for a move to a bigger club at the end of the season. That's what you probably expect.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I would, you know, if West Brom turn this into a permanent deal, then it goes down as their greatest ever signing. I'm saying it now, bold statement. But no, I think it's wonderful business. And that's part of the fun of the transfer window, I think. The fact that a club like West Brom, you know, who knows how these deals come about, scouts and contacts at clubs. Obviously, I'm sure we'll touch on Renato Sanchez going to Swansea, which is another, you know, complete left field signing. But I think Tony Pulis getting in a player like Krychowiak just speaks of that club's ambition. Hopefully they won't shut down seven games before the end of the season when safety is assured and they'll really push on.
That's your deadline day deal, wasn't it, John?
Mm-hmm.
Renato Sanchez.
I didn't do it.
I mean, your pick. Yeah,
definitely.
He was busy that week, wasn't he?
Definitely, because last year he was considered one of the best under-21s in world football, and he went to Bayern Munich before the Euro, so everyone thought Bayern were were getting not an absolute steal because he went for a lot of money, but they had maybe trumped a few of the other big clubs. Manchester United were said to be interested in him. It didn't work out at Bayern, but obviously Paul Clements used his contacts there at Bayern, and he's convinced them that, you know, Clements well known for being a very, very good coach, and he's probably convinced Carlo Ancelotti and whoever's above him there at Bayern that he can take Sanchez into his team and basically reignite him and play to the kind of level of football that Bayern thought that they were getting with him. So I think it's a fantastic signing, and he's someone who could really light up the Premier League with less pressure, you would imagine, than being out of Bayern Munich, even though maybe Swansea might be a bit of a goldfish bowl for him as well, because there'll be so much expectation on him. But I look forward to see what he does.
I think the one thing that Clement and Swansea are probably guaranteed Ancelotti and Bayern is that he will play games in the Premier League. And that's something that he didn't do, like you say, at Bayern last season. And it's something for his own development at his age that he needs to be doing constantly.
Okay, so if they're the best deals on transfer deadline day, what are the deals that stood out for you over the course of the entire summer as perhaps some of the worst?
I think for me, and I don't know if I'm avoiding the question here, the worst transfer dealings was the deals not done, and in particular by Arsenal. You know, again, everyone can pinpoint what is wrong with that team. They don't have a leader. They've not had a leader since Gilberto Silva left the club. They don't have that midfield presence, and they've gone another transfer window without addressing that problem. So for me, and sorry if I've skirted around it, but for me, that's the worst bit of transfer window business.
Corks?
It might be a bit more left field as well. I'd say Frank de Boer at Crystal Palace. He's what, three games in, and already he's either, you know, going to walk or he's going to get pushed. So he was supposed to come in and completely change the way Palace were going to play, and while that should be commended, it just looks like it's been an absolute disaster.
It was just too soon, too quick. You look at their managers though, Pulis, Pardew, Allardyce to Frank de Boer. Like that, you know, I know the whole quote about evolution, not revolution. It was never going to happen that quickly. But so what was your worst deal of the transfer window?
We were looking at it earlier on, and it's been a pretty, well, at least on paper, quite a solid transfer window all round for clubs, but mine is a deal that has been done for an exceptional player that's not actually coming for another season. Naby Keita was signed by Liverpool for £40-odd million, and that looks like incredible business. But what if what if his career is over tomorrow? You know, obviously never wish it on him, of course, but if he breaks his leg or something and his career's finished, and Liverpool have just spent nearly £50 million on a player that can't play for them.
But and that's the thing, like you say, the £48 million was just for his release clause. So he's now obviously still an RB Leipzig player playing in the Champions League, where potentially they could meet Liverpool at some stage. But in the summer, they still have to pay more money on top of that. That was just the release clause. Like, and again, I don't know the absolute ins and outs of the deals. But yeah, I agree with you at all. Yeah, why spend that much money on a player that you can't even call upon?
We'll come back to this podcast in 12 months when he's lighting up the Premier League and realise how wrong we were. Joining us on the phone from Barcelona is Andy Mitten. Andy, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you. Although it's raining heavily in Barcelona, which is happens so infrequently, it's worth mentioning.
Great. I wish we had a bit of rain here. That would be quite a nice change of scenery. Right, Andy, we'd really like to get your thoughts on really Philippe Coutinho, Barcelona and Liverpool. We've spent the majority of the podcast today discussing the transfer window and deadline day. And of course, one of the biggest deals that didn't go through this summer was Coutinho's potential move to Barcelona. And I'd really like to get your thoughts on that. There were various reports saying that he was, of course, desperate for a move to Barcelona. Barcelona, of course, were extremely determined to get the deal done. Liverpool, of course, dug their heels in and kept their man. What are your thoughts on the whole sort of Coutinho situation?
I think since the move hasn't gone through, as you often find in football, that there are two versions of the truth. The clubs will brief on and off the record their version to suit their constituents, Barcelona to suit Barcelona fans, Liverpool to suit Liverpool fans. And Barcelona called an unprecedented press conference on Saturday morning, and they got everybody to camp now, and people weren't quite sure what the news was going to be because there's a lot of uncertainty around the club at the moment. Was the president going to step down? That's what the journalists were speculating. And it was basically for the club to run through a PowerPoint presentation where they talked about the signings that they'd made and how great they were and how everything's fine. Then it was opened up to questions, and some of the journalists gave the Barcelona senior officials quite a strong grilling and tried to get to the bottom of the truth. The way I read the situation is the club are still reeling about the departure of Neymar. They didn't expect him to leave. When he did leave, when his buyout clause was met, Barca became increasingly desperate as the transfer window moved on to get rid of some of the money. The presidents have been having a hard time from the supporters. He's been making lots of mistakes. The players are dissatisfied. Real Madrid have become the best team in Spain, in Europe, in the world. Because that's not Barcelona, that is a problem for Barcelona. And they wanted Coutinho, and Coutinho wanted to come to Barca. As with many big English clubs, they're very wealthy, Liverpool. They don't need to sell anybody. And they were adamant that they weren't going to sell him. And this has only really happened in the last 5 years. When a player's said that he wants to go, they've tended to get the way. But it's happened really since Manchester United didn't let Wayne Rooney go to Chelsea in the summer of 2013. The club said, no, you have a contract, we're not selling you to a rival. And it's happened more and more. And English clubs are under very little financial pressure to sell players because of the huge windfall from commercial and especially television revenues. So Liverpool were adamant they weren't going to sell their best player, especially on the eve of the new season, whether he wanted to go or not. They didn't call his bluff, but they knew that if he stayed, he was still going to be a good footballer and he'd get over the disappointment and maybe will go in a year's time. Barca kept going back, kept increasing their offer, and Liverpool kept saying no. Barca's argument is that Liverpool asked for a world record fee on the final day. Liverpool have a completely contrasting view of that. Barca signed Dembele from Borussia Dortmund. He looks like a very, very good player. However, they seem to have paid way over the odds for him. But what are the odds now? The whole market has been vastly inflated because of television money. And this is the new order in football. A year ago, Paul Pogba's fee was seen as excessive at £90 million. And now, I wouldn't say it seems a bargain because it's too much money to seem a bargain, but the market has just been blown apart, as Manchester United suspected it would be a year ago when they said, we're going to see a 200 million player before long.
It seems that what Jose Mourinho, the Manchester United manager, said when he was asked about the Neymar deal, Andy, seems to have kind of come true, that Neymar moving to PSG isn't the major problem. It would be the knock-on effect of the valuation of players after that, of the players that Barcelona might be trying to sign. As you said, someone like Ousmane Dembele, who's clearly a very talented player, £150 million pre-Neymar leaving, it would seem absolutely crazy. But that seems to have been the kind of, it seems to be almost a double-edged sword for Barcelona. They've lost one of their key players, and now they were being priced out of moves for any possible replacements.
Yeah, that's all true. There's only a few players who you would class in the absolute top level. Neymar would certainly be one of them. So then clubs need to go to the tier below that. And the trend was there earlier in the summer when Manchester City paid £50 million for Kyle Walker. Why did that happen? Tottenham did not need to sell him. So if the club's in no desperation to sell, then that makes it more difficult. And English clubs are very, very wealthy. And that money is just passing straight through largely into increased wages, transfer fees and commissions for agents. And I spoke last week with Martin Edwards, who was the chairman of Manchester United for 23 years, and he was saying how sad he was. And that may elicit raised eyebrows from United fans, because Edwards was no commercial slouch himself, but how sad he was that this money was not being passed on to savings for fans. It was just going right through the game. And I cannot see the trend stopping. I couldn't, for as long as I've written about football, there has been outrage about transfer fees. And another thing Martin Edwards said was that Sir Matt Busby, probably Manchester United's greatest ever manager, him or Alex Ferguson, he stepped down in 1981 out of disgust, largely because of a £1.5 million transfer fee for Brian Robson. My Uncle Charlie was a player for Manchester United in the late 40s and early 50s. There was absolute outrage when he moved to Colombia He became one of the first British players to move abroad for £100 a week. He'd been on £11 a week as a star winger for Manchester United. As long as the money continues to come in, wages are going to continue to be inflated, transfer fees too. It seems ever more ridiculous year after year, but as football continues to grow in popularity and television companies continue to pay more money for the rights to it, where else is the money going to go to? The pressure will always be on it to be spent on star players.
Speaking of which, Andy, do you see ultimately Philippe Coutinho ending up at Barcelona perhaps next year?
Yes, I do. It's by no means guaranteed. Strange things can happen in football. He could have a bad season. He could get injured. But Barcelona is still very, very attractive to a footballer, especially a South American footballer, because the cultural links are stronger. He could think, look at all the great Brazilians who played there, Romario, Ronaldinho, Rivaldo. There's a stronger pull there than Liverpool. Now, Liverpool are high up the food chain. They're a great club. They've won 5 European Cups and 18 English League titles. But it's not Barcelona, and I think any rational Liverpool fan would accept that. But what you're seeing now is Barca and Madrid, they are at the top of the food chain when it comes to transfers, but there's been big disruption from Paris Saint-Germain, from the big English clubs because of the television money which has come in. Now, if you ask most people who would you rather play for in the world, most players would still probably opt for Barcelona or Real Madrid. But it's changing. The TV contracts are not as big in Spain as they are in England. The Spanish economy is not as wealthy as the British or English language economy around the world. So Spanish football is hugely popular. And I don't expect Barcelona or Madrid to suddenly become paupers because they are huge clubs then. Camp Nou holds 98,000, the Bernabeu 80,000. They're very adept commercially, although not as adept as Manchester United. And they're still the best teams in the world. Real Madrid are considerably better than any English football team and have been for 9 of the last 10 years. But I know, because I've spoken to senior people at Barcelona, they are worried about the increasing might of the English clubs, and now you've got this left field challenge from PSG, who are operating to a different set of financial rules, and they only have to work within FIFA's financial fair play. But from the people I speak to in football, UEFA and FIFA, they've gone quite soft on it. They're not enforcing financial fair play as stringently as perhaps they could do, and that definitely frustrates the clubs who are now losing out on the players, like Barcelona. Clubs who previously have always had a cocksure arrogance when it comes to picking off the best players from other clubs.
We've kind of covered all the deadline day stuff, boys. It's time to get into the, you know, football's back after the international break. Let's look ahead to the actual action. Massive, massive game kicking off the weekend. Manchester City, Liverpool. Liverpool can win that, can't they? What do you think?
Well, if they play the way they played against Arsenal, certainly. I know Arsenal played a lot into their hands as well, but I think it'd be a good time for Liverpool to play City, because I think Guardiola's still trying to find out what his best team is in terms of maybe so much kind of going forward. You know, will he play Aguero up front? Will he start, or will he be playing second fiddle, which sounds ridiculous to Gabriel Jesus? So I think it'll be interesting to see how City cope with their first real test of the season. I know they scraped through against Bournemouth just before the international break, but Liverpool should go there with a lot of confidence and buoyed by the fact that their attack, they've got this blistering attack that I think that they'll quite look forward to playing against Man City.
I think it'll be interesting after the international break. Players playing in South America, like Roberto Firmino, who I think for me is one of the most improved Premier League players over the past 12 months. Sadio Mane and Mohamed Salah playing in Africa qualifiers. And something that's very much overlooked is just how draining those games are on players in terms of the quality of the pitches in Africa. You know, that they tend to feel like playing two games in the space of one. So it will be very interesting to see. I imagine there will be quite a lot of rotation in both teams. Very interesting that Guardiola, stuck by Raheem Sterling. I know Arsenal were quite keen to use him as bait for any potential Sanchez deal, and City said no, straight cash deal. So I think that, that speaks a lot of Guardiola's faith in a player that, you know, perhaps a lot of us talk about as someone quite down that pecking order in terms of City's galaxy of midfield players. There's no reason why Liverpool shouldn't go there. And I think City are a lot stronger away from home anyway. Mm-hmm. I think, they're not the force, they're not the beast they should be at the Etihad. So, yeah, I think Liverpool will go there based on their first Premier League games of the season, thinking, yeah, we can take 3 points here.
There should be goals, shouldn't there? I think that's...
I think there'll be... the standard of defending so far has been awful. I'm really looking for a mass improvement up until January or up until the next international break.
Another good game to look out for, I think, on Saturday, Everton-Tottenham. That should be a good test for both teams.
Yeah, it will be. I think... thankfully for Tottenham that they're not playing at Wembley, so they might put in a vastly improved performance as they did against Burnley. It's another big test for Everton because they've got aspirations of breaking into the top six, and I don't know if their squad's quite good enough. It's massively improved over the summer, but I don't know.
But sorry to interrupt you, John. Again, they did great business, but the one thing they didn't address...
striker.
...was a striker mm-hmm. to replace Lukaku.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt
you. No, you're okay. It's a very valid point. That's it. I think that, as I said, it's a big test for Everton and, again, for Tottenham because they've started with, 4 points, is it, they have from 3 games, and... it's still very, very early, but you don't want to be losing too much sight on the teams above you, the teams that will be challenging for what you want to be challenging for at the end of the season.
At least it's not August anymore.
No, Harry Kane can go and score, can't he? He did for England in the qualifier against Malta. So that, he doesn't do very well in August. He doesn't do too badly up until May, though, does he? So, I think it'll be a good... challenge for Spurs. I think I disagree with Colts a little bit on the performance against Burnley. I don't think Spurs played that badly. And I know I said this after the game against Chelsea, but if we play that well against most teams at Wembley, then they will definitely win more games than they lose. But I do agree. I think it will be good to play this game away from Wembley, go there against a team who, like you say, want to move up to the next level, and Spurs can lay down a marker of putting a disappointing start to the Premier League season behind them by taking on an up-and-coming club wanting to potentially replace them in the hunt for European places.
Any other games stand out for you this weekend?
I think Stoke Man United is a quite tasty one. I think Stoke are, they're a team full of confidence at the moment, going up against a team who... are stacked full of confidence at the moment. What is it? 3 games, 10 goals, 0 conceded. And if you look at Manchester United's fixtures up until October, they're very, very favourable. And potentially we could be looking at 6 or 7 games without defeat, maybe even all victories. So United could open up a sizeable chunk of a lead on a lot of teams. But, they go to a Stoke team who were more than a match for Arsenal. They had a very good transfer window, got in some decent and solid players, and they'll be thinking, but, they can take United on in their own backyard.
Arsenal host Bournemouth, John. Bournemouth have struggled at the start of this season, a little bit unlucky at times, but they definitely can't lose that one, can they? Otherwise, it'll be full-blown crisis mode if it isn't already.
Yeah, 4 weeks into the season. I think that's quite... a nice match for Arsenal to have at this stage in terms of...
I think it's quite a nice match for Bournemouth to have, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a very good point. I just think that it's not going to be, a team that really gets into your face, like a Stoke, like where they came unstuck a couple of weeks ago at Stoke. So I just think that Eddie Howe likes to play expansive football to his detriment sometimes, because sometimes they do need to roll the sleeves up a little bit more. They've still got people like Harry Arter who does get stuck in, but I just think that maybe that's the kind of fixture that might suit Arsenal.
I think I know he played Jermaine Defoe from the start against
City, was it?
against Manchester City. Thank God you're here. And I think a lot of Bournemouth fans have been thinking, why has he not been playing from the start? And they did. They actually played okay against City, largely frustrated them for long periods. But, you know, I think a lot of Bournemouth fans are wanting to see the pairing of Josh King and Jermaine Defoe up front and see what kind of damage they can do.
I'm surprised someone didn't go for Josh King this summer. I'm a big fan. I think he's a real player.
Yeah, and I think he signed a new deal there as well, didn't they? So they've done really good business in maybe someone should recommend their director of football or whoever handles contracts to Arsenal. But, but they've done really, really good work there. Yeah, and I agree. I think he can definitely kick on to a great season that he had last season, alongside an experienced campaigner like Defoe.
Great stuff, chaps. That's all we have time for this week. Thanks.
We did it.
Thanks.
Oh, cheers, mate.
Cheers. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for popping by. Yeah. It's really good. I'm John Turner with John McCauley, Steve Luckings and Andy Mitten. Subscribe to Extra Time on iTunes and find us on the website at thenational.ae. Thanks for listening.